This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Welcome to another episode of The Hindu's In Focus podcast. I'm Zubeda Hamid, your host for today. A massive controversy has erupted in the world of spices, masalas, and mixes with products of two leading Indian players, MDH and Everest, in the midst of this. The Hong Kong and Singapore governments suspended the sale and withdrew certain masalas of these two brands, stating that they contained higher than permissible limits of a pesticide, ethylene oxide. Multiple governments of other countries have now announced investigations into these products from India. After this, the Spices Board and the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India, or FSSAI, announced a slew of measures for spices as well as other foods to test for contamination, residues, and to ensure that they are up to standard. In the meantime, though, the FSSAI has been under criticism for another issue, the allowing of a tenfold increase in the maximum residue limit from 0.01 milligrams per kg to 0.1 in spices and herbs in cases of pesticides that are not registered in India or in cases of pesticides where the maximum limit is not defined in Indian or international regulations. So what is going on with pesticides and masalas in India? How unsafe are these foods, especially processed and ultra-processed foods that are sold in India? What are the regulations that we have in place and how effectively are these being implemented? Do we need a more stringent system to ensure food safety and public health in India? We delve into these issues with Dr. Vandana Prasad, a community pediatrician and public health professional associated with the Public Health Resource Network. Welcome to the Hindus in Focus podcast, Dr. Vandana Prasad.
Thank you so much.
Doctor, let's start with the current controversy over contamination of certain MDH and Everest spice mixes and their ban in several countries. The allegation is that ethylene oxide, a pesticide, residues of this have been found in these spice masalas. Could you talk to us about what ethylene oxide is, how is it used in food, and how it affects the human body?
Yes, so I mean, I think as your readers would already know from the public hue and cry that has been raised, this is basically a fumigant and it is used to control, I mean, it's used as a pesticide to control fungi, bacterial growth, and is used as part of food processing so that the food can be kind of sterilized before it is processed and packed and kind of sent here and there for consumption. So obviously, these are not things that would apply to fresh cooked meals, for instance. It is really something that is introduced into food as part of processing. And the concern, as I think, again, as has been mentioned in all the articles, the concern is that there are links between the existence of or the consumption of these kinds of pesticides or derivatives and cancers of various variety.
So it is known to be a carcinogen, is that correct?
Yes, yes. It is known to be associated with carcinomas.
So then in that, should it really be used in food at all? That's the larger question, isn't it?
So see, I mean, these things are quite complex and they are part of a very specialized kind of area of research and work. There would be many things in the world that are associated with carcinogenesis, but cannot be done without or cannot be banned. And, you know, there are degrees of how much they would affect the risks of cancer. Most of the things that we talk about in public health are not exactly causations. It's not a direct vertical relationship between consumption and the occurrence of cancer. We really talk in terms of increased risks. And that's how, you know, things are evaluated. So, and there are ranges for that. And so I think in most carcinogens, it would be a case of regulation. I mean, for instance, alcohol, not alcohol, I would say tobacco is one of the most widely accepted carcinogens for lung cancer, but we don't get entirely rid of it, do we? So I think that there is a case for regulating things that are known to be associated with cancer simply because there are so many of them. I mean, anything in excess can cause harm and toxicity to the body. Allergens can be there which affect one person more than another. So these are complex relationships, and regulation is definitely called for, especially as science progresses. So the more that we know, I mean, centuries ago, we didn't know as much about tobacco. And so the regulatory procedures for tobacco would have been less stringent as compared to what they are now. I mean, countries like the UK, I'm told, are moving towards a complete ban on sales for people of a particular generation. So the new generation coming up would not be able to purchase tobacco products. So giving tobacco just as a very commonly used example, which is uncontroversial, as compared to things that are coming up newly, chemicals that are, you know, emerging slowly but surely as carcinogenic. And I mean, we know that, for instance, DDT was banned. So there are processes, there are scientific processes that basically take some time before something can be identified as being a major carcinogenic that requires a total ban as compared to regulation. So regulation is definitely called for, especially the more we know about chemicals and chemical additives to food. And I think if we talk in general principles, the general principle of having the least possible processing, the least possible chemical intervention is obviously, you know, commonsensical approach to follow for food. But when it comes to regulating and large amounts of, commercial interests are involved, this would have impact on, you know, import, export, then greater care and consideration has to be taken about what levels to set and so on and so forth. And that's why countries have their own different parameters. It is a complex scenario. So it's a little simplistic to say, why is it even permitted at all? Also because, you know, these things, they tend to flow in the environment. I think that's an important point that all regulation must understand, that you cannot control the flow of chemicals across water, land, soil, from one source to another through air. So we have to be talking about a general environment where there is much less use of pesticides, chemicals, and so on. Even as we go in for regulating specific foods. So the fact that it is over-present in a masala is giving you some sense of an overall environment of where this is going to be found floating around, you know. So after all, where is the masala coming from? It is coming from foodstuff. So even unprocessed foodstuff would be containing some. So I think that these relationships have to be understood when you create a general philosophy of food production, processing, consumption in a country. And I think that is where actually India is very, very primitive. I mean, very unadvanced in this kind of comprehensive look at our food systems and what they're going to be doing, especially from the point of view of public health. I mean, I think that is a major gap, that we don't have much public health expertise emerging in these areas as fast as we should. So I think food, I mean, even for myself, as an example, I'm a public health professional and I've been working in the area of nutrition for 3 decades. But food safety and toxins, these have been, you know, something that I have only started to think about in the last decade or so. So I think that we need to do much more work for public health professionals to be considering food safety and to be actually involving in food policy, food safety policy making.
You said, Doctor, that regulations were the need of the hour. Why is it that, like, this level of residues, ethylene oxide, that has been found in these spice masalas has been detected in countries abroad, but not so much over here? And if so, do we need a system where we are also putting in our own checks and balances when it comes to processed food?
Oh, surely. I mean, I think that there's no question in my mind that India is perceived, and I think correctly so, as a space where a lot of regulations can be flaunted. I mean, can be just dismissed or not be considered because we just don't have a system of good control. And big food industry knows that very well. That's also the reason why they are selling products in India, which they would not consider selling in Europe or in America or in Britain for that matter. I mean, simply because our regulations are not as tight. Even when there are regulations, the testing is not great. And there is a general sense that there is not a lot of concern, you know, and that you can actually get away by doing a lot more of what would not be permitted and would be detected very fast in other countries. And we do know that countries like Singapore and Hong Kong are very, very stringent. They're very tight on their regulation on food and things. Countrywide, there are differences, and then there are differences in implementation. So we really don't have a great implementational structure here. I mean, we have our own Swami Ramdev Ji, who's now being pulled up by the Supreme Court for being able to advertise things that are blatantly false. It needs civil society to actually shout and fight and scream, and Supreme Courts to come in, rather than our own regulatory machinery, because it's not geared to doing that. And that is unfortunate. And this is perceived by the entire, the global community, and especially global commerce. So we are having products go around. I mean, there was a time when GM foods were brought into India as part of charity from America. That was corn. I mean, I remember this in the early days in the 90s and early 2000s, and distributed through the ICDS. So that this was corn that was going waste in the US, because they were not permitted to use it, or they had excess, and they just felt they could just send it off to a country where there was no regulation on it. And it was only when a big UN cry was raised about it that, how come we're forcing our children to, in the name of welfare, eat things without any labeling or any consent or any regulation. And then it was had to be taken back. So, I mean, these things have happened time and time again. And we've seen it with, you can see the sugar content in various soft drinks, in various child food supplements.
Infant food.
Yeah, infant foods. So this can happen blatantly in India because we don't have regulations. And when we are demanding regulations, as you know, many of us have been demanding stricter regulations, especially on so-called junk foods and high fat, high sugar, high salt, in the context of a really emergency for NCD incidents in India, and for obesity, on the rise, and the impact it has on public health. But we don't find that kind of sensitivity or concern amongst our own regulatory framework. I mean, they come into play only when they're pushed to do so against a wall. They're not doing it proactively. That's sad.
Talk to us a little bit about the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India. I mean, this is supposed to be our nodal regulatory body, so to speak, set up under the Ministry of Health. What is its role essentially in tackling food safety challenges in India, and how well? We just talked about the fact that regulations are not implemented and are flouted on a regular basis over here. How well is it tasked to be able to monitor the situation?
So I think it has the mandate, and it has the mandate to regulate all foods, and it can really essentially do what it wants. I mean, it has a scientific committee, they look at data, and there is a mandate to regulate food. But what is the intention? I think, and I have been speaking to that when I've been talking to you, that essentially we don't see a public health approach. So, I mean, I can give the example of the front of pack labeling drama that has been happening over the last many years, and I've been quite engaged with that. That, for instance, many of us, some of this work has been led by Dr. Arun Gupta and the, NAPI platform that we have created together, to say that we need a better regulation of junk foods or foods with high salt, sugar, and fat, as happens in many other countries. And what we've been demanding is front-of-pack labeling of a particular kind, which is warning labels. So though front-of-pack labeling has been more or less accepted by FSSAI and the Ministry of Health as being something that is a valid kind of demand, but the type of front-of-pack labeling that they obviously favored has been health star rating. So where essentially even the worst of the worst foods would get at least half a golden star, rather than a warning label saying this is too high in sugar, fat, and salt. Now, it seems very logical, rational, reasonable to assume that if something is too high in sugar or fat or salt, what's the problem with the food specifically just saying that it's too high? Why should it not happen? But we have been told, I've been told to my face by an FSSAI official that, madam, we have to listen to big food also. We have to listen to the industry. But I don't think that should be the concern. I mean, obviously, from my point of view as a public health person, I would think that the public health, the health of the Indian public should be the primary concern of a regulatory authority, not protecting the commercial interests of companies who would look out for themselves. I mean, they do that. They have done in other countries. So why should we be so concerned about their well-being? They will look out for themselves. They have all the wherewithal to look after their own self-interests. So I don't think that a government authority and government machinery should be looking out for private self-interest. They should be looking out for the well-being of the public. And that we do feel that there is a problem there. We're not able to influence the FSSAI sufficiently from the public health point of view, that there is also a certain degree of conflict of interest. I mean, there are the whole fortification business has been another case study. I mean, there are many such experiences that we've had over the last many decades. So the front of pack labeling has been one story. The fortification of rice with iron has been another story. Toxicity, this is coming up. This is another story. The advertising of, as health foods, which are not at all health foods, too high in sugar is one other story where certain victories have been, gained at simply because people continue to raise these issues. And now this toxicity is, yet another story. And I'm sure that many more such stories are going to continue to emerge because it is the public who's being forced to, I mean, the consumers for their own protection who are raising these issues. And we are really not seeing the regulatory authority clamp down. Yeah, the Ramdev story was another such story. You can see, I mean, these are all in the very recent past, one after the other. Supreme courts and civil society organizations, PILs, having to raise these issues with the government, which really it's government's job to be proactively protecting us against. So this is the situation as it is. And we do know that commercial interests play a big role in policymaking across the world. And we do know that in India, consumer voices have not matured. And, we don't have that mass of consumer kind of influence as you would have in Western societies. So these are the problems. And I think one other problem I would like to raise is we have this entire informal sector. So, as civil society activists, we are also trying to be careful that regulatory mechanisms should not favor big commercial interests and, like industrial farming approaches vis-a-vis the small landholding communities of farmers and people in the informal sector who would find it much harder to fulfill certain standards. So this is another complexity. It's another paradox that while we ask for regulation, we must be sure that, the socioeconomic impacts of that regulation upon the large informal sector, I mean, like agriculture, food processing, etc., a lot of it is in the informal sector. And that is really hand to mouth. They don't have big pockets, deep pockets like the corporate sector. So that is another complexity, but it's not as though, I mean, I don't think that we are under-regulating, keeping that in mind either. So it is a complex scenario. It's not easy to achieve a regulation that is fair, that is just, that does justice to people who are not as well off, but are part of this whole food system that we have in India. I mean, India is a very peculiar case. So, but here what we're seeing is that big food seems to be favored in every possible way. So I think that is something that we need to definitely kind of warn against. Yeah.
Speaking about our particular story about toxicity, ma'am, there has been an outcry recently over FSSAI's increasing the maximum residue limit for pesticides in spices and herbs. It has been reported that it's a tenfold increase from 0.01 milligrams per kg to 0.1 milligram per kg. Could you talk to us about this and what is this FSSAI clarification that this is only for spices that are not regulated in India?
Yes, not registered.
Sorry,
yes.
There are for pesticides that are not registered in India. Does this mean that we have pesticides that are not registered in India that are being used also?
Yes, so I mean, this is quite a peculiar explanation. I mean, there are two, three facts that I will point out. So one is that, as FSSAI has clarified also, there is a range of what would be considered safe. And the codex would give one range. Different countries have adopted different ranges. And the FSSAI has clarified that also. But at the same time, there are some things that we must consider. One is, I think that, as you pointed out, that why are we giving more liberality to those pesticides that have not even been registered? I would expect that that would be the opposite case, no? So if something is not registered, I think first and foremost, it should be registered so that it can be brought under regulatory control. And if it is not registered and still has to be accommodated, why would we give it a more liberal protection than what we already have, which is 0.01? So why would we do that? I think they might have a logic, but certainly that has not been communicated to the general public. And it needs to be, because tenfold is not a small degree. At the same time, it is still within the range of some of these in the codex. I mean, I don't know whether these unregistered pesticides come anywhere at all within those ranges. Probably if they're not registered anywhere, they have not also been studied. So this is a peculiar kind of justification, because one would have a greater, as a lay person, I would have a greater wariness of something that is not registered rather than a less wariness. So that is one part of the story. The other, I think another fact that tells us that in general, there is an environment of overuse, which is being overlooked, which is that the percentage of, even those tested food products has gone up between, from what I can make out, I think something like 23% to 36% in the last 5-6 years. So failing the regulatory test, meaning a higher percentage of food products is now failing regulation as compared to earlier. So that means that there is a general environment of both of overuse of pesticides and toxins, and as well as escaping regulatory mechanisms. I mean, that these foods have come out into the open market, then they have been tested and found to fail. So I think all these facts in consideration are rather peculiar, and that one would expect that if some toxins or pesticides, every pesticide has potential toxicity. There is no pesticide in the world that is not toxic. And so they all have to be registered and regulated. Now, if some have escaped registration, then surely the regulation on them should be more stringent than less stringent. This would be the general logic. If there is some other logic that has been used, or some other studies that have been used, all that I think that civil society organizations are saying, please make these public. After all, we are the ones who are eating this food. It affects our life, our health. So what's the problem in being transparent about this? So make it public. And as I've said also, that different countries will use different ranges depending on their context. And the context does include, specifically I'm saying this again, does include who is producing food and what is their own socioeconomic context and what is their status and how much are we supporting them for standardization, for regulation, for achieving standards and so on. And what is the process that we've set for the support of people who can't necessarily afford testing, labeling. I mean, we've seen this happen to the SAG movement in India, where they are involved in food processing, but the standards have been set so high that finally the SAGs cannot compete and only big food can do it. So these are also things to be cautious about. So we need an FSSAI that has a full sensitivity to public health and also has some understanding of the socioeconomic, implications of regulatory standards. And standards are very complicated things. I've been working on many, many different types of standards related to nutrition and health. And they are very complex and they're also very political. So maybe that for another podcast. Yes.
You mentioned the codex, ma'am, and that's what FSSAI said as well, that if the maximum residue limit is not there, then they're going to go by the codex standard. But codex has also been under fire recently post the Nestle controversy of having, for instance, allowing, for instance, way too much sugar in infant food. So perhaps India needs its own standards, as you said, and its own to devise its own regulation limits. Is that something that's actively happening?
So this is a difficult question to answer because, in India, we play both cards. Sometimes when it suits us, we hearken to global standards. And when it doesn't suit us, we say we must create Indian standards. So I think that this is something that needs much more debate, and it also case by case. Like, for instance, in growth standards for infants, we have been arguing that we would like to continue to follow global standards. And there's a reason to do that. Now, on toxins and pesticides, I would say that, again, as a layperson, because these are very, very complex and you need a lot of understanding of chemicals and biochemicals and also of rules and regulations. So these are scientifically, it's very complex and challenging. But I would say that if there are countries in the world that have more stringent standards, and if India is such an aspirant to join the global, excellence, then I think that we should be using more stringent rather than less stringent standards. This would be my overall observation on chemical use in food. And this also takes us back to the entire discussion on food systems on the whole. You know, where are we going with our food systems? I mean, India is, again, we are lucky in some sense that a lot of our households are still using a whole lot of freshly cooked food. But the food, where is it coming from? There is now a growing kind of concern for natural farming, organic farming. But again, that's not accessible to most of us, and it's going to be expensive. Is there government support to get rid of, at some point of time, to move towards organic and natural farming? I think this is a larger question. And this is, these are questions that we need to answer at a very, at a supreme policymaking space. I mean, this is something for the PMO. I mean, this cannot be done by an FSSAI or a single ministry even. This is something that requires a huge amount of debate and discussion in India as a society. What are the food systems we are going for? Are we going for making the mistakes that the West has made in terms of super processing, you know, ultra processing? You would know, if you know our work, that we've been also talking about ultra processed foods needing regulation per se, even if they're not high in sugar, salt and fat. Just the fact that they're ultra processed makes them unhealthy. There's a growing body of evidence, and we try to present this growing of body of evidence to FSSAI also. But they said, well, there is not enough evidence. So I think that, you know, this needs much more debate and discussion amongst us. What are we moving towards as a country? What kind of agriculture? What kind of food production? Is it going to be a decentralized food system where you try to eat locally? That also means that you will not be getting, you know, some fruits all through the year. You will be only eating them in season. What's wrong with that? You know, so I think this needs a much larger societal informed debate. And this is something that many of us are actively working towards. And the regulatory space and mechanism is one very narrow tool amongst this whole thing. There's a huge market involved. And the market depends on selling us food products that are not good for our health and not good for the environment. I mean, this is the other thing, that climate change, environment, these things are all wrapped up in everything that we're talking about today. It is very difficult to talk of one, you know, in one direction, regulatory, and in the other direction, keep doing harm to the environment, keep doing harm to the food system, make it more and more process-oriented or ultra-process-oriented, more and more machinized, more and more industrial. Then regulation can never keep pace. It's never going to happen. So we need to look at root causes. We need a regulatory mechanism that is more geared to public health and is more also amenable to what people are saying. We need an advertising and, control over advertising and misadvertising that is so problematic in our country, even though we have some of the best laws, I mean, like the IMS Act, but flaunted all the time. So we need, you know, all of these things to happen together, because we are really moving towards a disaster. And it's a disaster that people are, you know, shoving under the carpet and not really looking at till it's too late. The environment and our food systems are going to be in permanent decline. And other countries will escape. I mean, they have made these mistakes, but they are now recovering from their mistakes. And companies are shifting to us because they think that we have this large, naive population with no regulation and very poor implementation of laws. So let's exploit the situation in India. And I think that is something we have to be wary of.
That is, even to hear that is highly depressing. I am going to end this here, Dr. Vandana. Thank you so much for speaking to us. Maybe if you could just go a quick answer about what you'd like to see going forward in terms of teeth. There have been a lot of reports saying that even testing laboratories are not in place in multiple states. A lot of the companies are asked to do voluntary testing, which obviously is not maybe the right way to do it. So in terms of arming the regulatory body that we do have with teeth, is there also a lot more that needs to be done?
Absolutely. I mean, like what I've been saying is that food systems and nutrition and public health need to be given due priority, and no government has really done that. Even if you look at some of the manifestos that we're seeing, I mean, other than one or two that are fairly detailed, what is the space that is being accorded to nutrition, to public health and food systems and agriculture? Very, very little. And all these are in crisis. I think that if we continue down a course where we assume that economic growth is everything, and that also this highly inequitable economic growth that we have in this country, bizarrely inequitable, because you know that the richest maybe 0.5% can afford to eat organic food every meal, but the 99.5% would not be able to even afford it. So I think this assumption is completely misplaced, that GDP is all, this unequal distributed GDP is all, economic growth is all. What good will economic growth do us if the majority of our population is malnourished, either in the undernourished category or in the obese category, when the majority of our population has diabetes, hypertension, and all kinds of NCDs, growing rates of cancer, where the majority of our population is just, you know, being used as sheep for commercial interests from other countries to come and sell bad products in. I mean, this is not surely the image that we want to present to the world. So I think that we need a far, far greater kind of focus, and a very visible focus by political leaders and by policymakers, on health, on nutrition, on food systems, on decentralization of all of these, to ensure that the poorest of the poor get a decent deal, and the rest of us as well. I mean, this is not something involving only the poorest of the poor. This is the entire middle class. As I said, 99.5% of us, what we go out and buy these days, you have no, absolutely no guarantee of safety when you're buying your fruits and vegetables, how much chemical there is going to be in it. So it needs a complete overhaul. And this is going to need public policy support, government support. As you said, laboratories is one part of it, supporting better forms of agriculture that will be more expensive. So we will need more support for millet production. We will need more support for natural farming, for organic farming, integrated farming. There is a long-term benefit of this. Maybe in the short term, it might cost us a little bit more. But the long-term benefits on environment, on carbon footprint, on the quality of our water, our soil, our fruits and vegetables, and our own health is very, very worth it. But unfortunately, we are so short-sighted. We can't look beyond the next election and who we want to vote in and immediate power. We are not taking these kinds of long-sighted approaches, which may be slower, gentler, but definitely much better for the population and the health and the environment and the globe on the whole and the world. So we are trying to push for that. I wouldn't be so depressed. Just keep struggling. People always win. We have won some battles, as I said. We won a small little battle against some very big food companies, in terms of them being able to advertise, in terms of them cutting down on their sugar content. All this has happened as a result of struggles that sometimes have been led by single individuals. So hats off to all those single individuals who are fighting and struggling. And I'm sure that the government will respond, will have to be made to respond, because it's a democracy and there are elections that do happen. So we continue to fight and struggle and not be so depressed about it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mandal Prasad. Really lovely talking to you, as always. Thank you.
Take care. Take care. Bye.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.